Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, President Bush says his stellar vision for manned missions to the moon and Mars is affordable. Others disagree.
The numbers for a moon and Mars mission are so astronomically high, to make a bad pun. You get into money figures that basically parallel the national debt if you want to do it in a short time in the next 10 years, say.
Also, what is a caucus? An Iowan explains.
Generally, people go to different parts of the room. The Gephardt people in one corner and the Dean people in another corner. And that way you can get some sense of the support across the range of candidates who are active.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Former Enron Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fastow and his wife Lee Fastow are expected to enter guilty pleas today in Houston. Media reports indicate it's part of a deal with prosecutors investigating the collapse of the energy giant. Jack Williams with member station KUHF reports.
Andrew Fastow is expected to enter his guilty plea first in federal court, followed by his wife. A similar deal fell apart last week, but both sides have reportedly come to an agreement that would send Andrew Fastow to prison for 10 years and his wife for at least 5 months. Andrew Fastow would be the highest-ranking Enron official to plead guilty so far. The energy giant collapsed 2 years ago amid a scandal involving outside partnerships and schemes to hide losses. Enron's former chairman, Ken Lay, and former CEO, Jeffrey Skilling, both maintain their innocence and have not been charged. Prosecutors are hoping both Fastows will cooperate as they investigate whether Skilling or Lay played a part in the collapse. For NPR News, I'm Jack Williams in Houston.
Israeli officials say at least 4 people are dead after a Palestinian woman blew herself up at the main crossing point between Israel and Gaza Strip. The BBC's Chris Morris has more from Jerusalem.
The first suicide bombing of the new year, carried out by a 21-year-old mother of 2 from Gaza. She set off a metal detector as she was passing through a security area, but she told the soldiers there that she had metal pins in her leg. As she was taken to one side to be checked again, she blew herself up, killing 3 soldiers and a civilian. Part of the roof was ripped off by the blast. There are bloodstains and shrapnel holes on the walls of the room. In Gaza, the Palestinian militant groups Hamas and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade have claimed joint responsibility for the attack. In response, Israel has said the Palestinians have proved again that they're not serious about peace.
BBC reporter Chris Morris. In central Iraq, a suicide bomber killed himself and at least 2 others in a car bomb explosion outside a police station in Samarra. Police say the driver attempted to enter the walled compound surrounding the station this morning, but guards then opened fire. The car exploded. The Iraqi deputy minister, interior minister in Baghdad, says 31 people were injured. More than half of them were civilians. The United Nations says Libya has ratified the nuclear test ban treaty. Less than 3 weeks ago, the North African country vowed to scrap its programs to build weapons of mass destruction. The International Atomic Energy Agency says Libya has agreed to allow UN inspectors to set up a monitoring station to verify compliance. UN officials say Libya was never close to producing an atomic bomb. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are up 4 points to 10,501 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite is up 8 points to 2105. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, another major toy chain has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Massachusetts-based KB Toys, in a statement, blames what it calls stiff pricing competition during the just-completed holiday season. From member station WBUR, Alex Ashlock has this report.
On the heels of a soft holiday season in the competitive toy sector, Massachusetts-based KB Toys is seeking Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection from its creditors. KB Toys is the second major toy chain to file for bankruptcy in 2 months, joining the parent company of FAO Schwarz, which filed its petition in December. There had already been signs of trouble for KB Toys. Following lackluster holiday sales, the toy chain had suspended payments to its vendors. Analysts say bigger retailers such as Walmart and Target took sales away from KB Toys and FAO Schwarz. Walmart, the world's largest retailer, and Target both cut their toy prices ahead of the important holiday shopping season. For NPR News, I'm Alex Ashlock in Boston.
More exports and fewer imports narrowed the nation's trade deficit to $38 billion in November. That's down nearly $3.5 billion from October. Exports were up $2.5 billion from the month before. Increased sales of civilian aircraft contributed to the rise. Imports fell slightly, though they stayed well above the level of goods and services U.S. manufacturers shipped overseas. Cingular Wireless and AT&T may soon be under one roof. The two communications companies reportedly are discussing a possible merger or acquisition. If the two mega companies get together, it would create the country's largest wireless carrier with about 45 million customers. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop features Driveway Moments, a CD compilation of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A vision of manned missions to the moon and Mars will be presented this afternoon by President Bush. A call for Americans to again traverse the 800,000-mile round trip to the moon and brave for the first time the 100-million-mile round trip to Mars. As for the perhaps rather earthbound quibble of cost, NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe said this morning on NBC's Today Show, the money will be there.
This is always the annual debate about what priorities should be of what we should spend public funding and taxpayer funding on. And so as a consequence, that won't be any different in this respect. We have to establish why it is that great nations doing great things in developing technologies, exploring science, is worth that investment.
But is NASA dreaming when O'Keefe also says the space agency's present 1% of the federal budget is enough? That's about $15 billion. We're joined by Greg Easterbrook of The New Republic. Greg, welcome.
Hi, Bill.
Greg, thanks for joining us. What do you make of NASA's assertion that it can send people to the moon and Mars working within its current budget?
The numbers for a moon and Mars mission are so astronomically high, to make a bad pun, that even if you assume these things can be done on a technical basis, and probably they can, you get into money figures that basically parallel the national debt if you want to do it in a short time in the next 10 years, say.
Greg, take us through it as briefly and concisely as you can.
Well, the most concise way to think about the moon is this. The program cost for the space station that's currently in orbit is $100 billion. The space station is in orbit. It doesn't have to leave orbit. If your goal was simply to move the space station to the moon or to do a similar thing on the moon, you'd look at about double the cost, somewhere around $200 billion to do that and set aside whether it makes sense, just the cost. If you think about Mars, the obstacles are far greater because you've got a transit time there and back of more than a year. The Spirit rover, the thing that's currently just landed on the surface of Mars, cost $410 million, and it weighs about half a ton. A Mars mission, a very conservative estimate, would be 1,000 tons for the spacecraft. And unlike Spirit, that spacecraft would have to come back. So when you look at projections for any kind of reasonable, safe sort of Mars mission, you're looking at projections in the $400 to $600 billion program cost range.
In fact, when the first President Bush brought up the possibility of a mission to Mars, he was told back during his administration that it would cost $400 billion. Greg, why are they saying that they can do it, as I understand, within their current budget? That sounds like a whopper.
Yes. It's a total whopper. They know there's not any chance on earth this is true. This is budget politics foot in the door. They want to get their foot in the door by promising something that's completely impossible. And once the program is funded, and then it becomes impossible to stop because congressional districts and contractors are involved, then they'll admit the true cost. That's how the space shuttle was funded.
Shouldn't great nations have great visions?
There's no doubt in my mind that men and women will someday stand on Mars. Men and women may someday even live on Mars. That doesn't mean that it's practical today. What NASA needs is to find a cheaper, safer way of putting pounds into orbit.
Greg, what about the politics of all this? A thriving NASA means jobs in several states, right?
Well, of course. Since the end of the Apollo moon program, which achieved a valid national identity objective, there's been a keen desire to keep the manned space program alive in the short term, just because it means so much, especially to Alabama, Ohio, Florida, and Texas, yeah, where the manned space program headquarters are. Everybody in NASA knows that the shuttle is a clunker. Everybody in NASA knows that the space station is a clunker. With two clunker programs eating up almost all of their money, they hope to get something that sounds inspirational, setting aside whether it makes sense. From the other side of the coin, this is a blank check for aerospace contractors. There is some national interest in keeping aerospace contractors in business. There's at least some justification for them, but I'd rather that tax money handed to aerospace contractors be used to build things that are useful, at least.
Would Congress ever put through a plan that would cost in the $600 billion range to send men and women to Mars?
If they approve it, and they might not, they will probably do what they do with the space station. When the space station basic planning documents were approved by Congress in 1984, the cost projection was $16 billion. Everyone knew that that was a phony number. Congress said, well, if it will only cost $16 billion, of course we'll pay it. Now, instead, they're paying $100 billion, which was the real number all along. If they decide to approve the Mars mission, they will probably approve some completely phony, imaginary low number. And then 5 years from now, you and I will be having the same conversation about how Congress feels locked into funding the Mars cost overruns. Gee, why didn't they know about this in the beginning?
Well, we always look forward to a conversation with Greg Easterbrook. Greg, thanks a lot.
Sure thing, Bill.
Greg Easterbrook writes for The New Republic.
When this country's first known case of mad cow disease was discovered nearly a month ago, federal agencies moved quickly to reassure a nervous public. But unanswered questions remain about mad cow disease and its human counterpart, CJD, or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Questions such as, how do you explain the 7 cases of CJD among patrons of a New Jersey racetrack? And could there be human infections lurking undetected? Todd Hartman is a staff writer with the Rocky Mountain News. He's been reporting on these issues. He joins us from Denver. Todd, a bit of quick background. Mad cow is caused by a prion. That's a particular kind of protein. If people eat that protein, some of them get a particular form of CJD. And that is always fatal, correct?
Well, it is believed to be always fatal, Rob, and that's an issue that there are some questions about. But, yeah, generally, scientists working in Great Britain have concluded that ingestion of these prions in infected cattle can result in human cases of variant or new variant CJD Creutzfeldt-Jakob.
But there is also a spontaneous form of CJD that some people get that isn't linked to mad cow, right?
That's correct. This is often called sporadic or classical CJD, and this is, scientists believe, this disease has been around probably for decades, longer than mad cow, and strikes perhaps 1 in a million people. The disease has similar symptoms to variant CJD or a human form of mad cow, but it is not believed to be the same disease and not believed to be linked to eating infected meat. At least that's been the conventional wisdom up until now.
Well, then tell us about these 7 cases of CJD among people who ate at a racetrack in New Jersey. What form of CJD do they have?
Sure, and I caution, this isn't a story I reported independently, but credit goes to the Philadelphia Inquirer here. But these people, it is believed they have the sporadic or the classical form of CJD, the 1 in a million form. But it's highly unusual, though, because of the rarity of that disease, to have 7 people clustered around a single place or an event. Therefore, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, has some curiosity about this case.
Because the thinking is that perhaps, I mean, again, we caution, it might have something to do with mad cow?
Well, apparently the 7 people all ate at this racetrack. And there's also another sort of scary issue about these 7 cases. At least one of them involves a very young victim, 29 years old. The classical or sporadic form of CJD, non-mad cow version, typically only strikes older folks over 60. New variant CJD, the mad cow version, on the other hand, typically does strike younger people in their 20s and 30s. Mm. So the fact that one of these cases, at least one, involves a young person, at minimum, that's interesting, if not a big red flag.
Well, and you write that there are studies in animals that seem to, you know, lend some credence to this thinking that perhaps the classical may be
related to mad cow. But as some critics of that thinking are saying, well, if there are cases of classical CJD that may be related to mad cow, wouldn't there also be many more of the variant cases of CJD, which we know are related to mad cow?
This is true. One thing that scientists are saying, well, look, if all these classical cases might be mad cow, then why aren't we also seeing cases of the, you know, quote-unquote legitimate mad cow? And that's an unanswered question. But these mice studies that were done in which mice were injected with mad cow disease, the fact is some of those mice ended up, to the shock of scientists, showing signs of the classical or sporadic version of CJD. So that really lent some credence to the idea that just maybe some of these classical cases are actually related to eating infected meat. And, of course, these are mice studies, and one has to be careful and keep that in perspective. And the way things work in the lab, of course, are far different than the way things work in the real world.
Well, Todd, thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Todd Hartman, staff writer with the Rocky Mountain News in Denver, Colorado.
In Jerusalem, where for millennia building of one kind or another has gone on, a wall is going up. Slabs of concrete as high as 25 feet, part of a 21-mile-long barricade meant to separate Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli officials say it's a temporary measure against terrorist attacks, like yesterday's suicide bombing on the Gaza Strip that killed four Israelis. But Palestinians say the wall only inflames hatred by making the lives of Palestinians more difficult than ever. We're joined now by Waleed Ayad, a lecturer at Abu Dhabi University in East Jerusalem, where the wall is currently going up. Welcome, Mr. Ayad.
Thank you.
How is the wall affecting you and your family?
Well, in myself, in my case, and my family, and many people that I know from my village, it is difficult for us now to go to Jerusalem, either for in my case, to teach inside Jerusalem, or people who are sick who needs to go to hospital. Some people who live next to the wall, sometimes the sun sets on them about noon time. And this wall, as many people believe, doesn't bring any type of peace. It's the opposite. It brings the hate and inflame hate again.
Mr. Ayad, what do you teach?
I teach logical thinking, and sometimes I teach politics and management for upper division.
So how do you get to your classes if the wall's between you and the university you teach at?
Well, I climbed the wall now. Before, they had the wall about 2 meters high, so we try to crack and we go. But now it's about 20, 25 feet high. No way I can go.
So what are you going to do?
We'll try to teach in other campus, because we have our university have 3 campuses, and probably many students, many teachers, they cannot go nor come from there. So life will be difficult for us here.
Now, there are gates in the wall, right?
No, there isn't for the moment.
But eventually, when it's at its full 25-foot height?
We don't know yet.
You're not sure yet.
Probably the gate will be far away from us, about 5 to 6 miles away.
Are other members of your family affected by this wall?
Oh, many people. Many people, they die. They have no time to go to the hospital. Many people, they have stroke. Some ladies, they were pregnant. Some, my children, for example, they cannot go to school now. I have to move them from Jerusalem to the other side of Jerusalem. They can't cross now. People, they go from my village, for example, to pray in the mosque. They cannot go now to Jerusalem to pray. Many families, for example, for holidays or like visiting families, cousins, brothers, friends, now both, they are living in both sides of the wall.
Mr. Ayad, can you understand the fear among Israelis?
Mm-hmm.
Suicide bombers come across from East Jerusalem sometimes, and they kill Israeli civilians.
We don't want it. We don't want any civilian to be killed, neither in both sides. What we want is peace between us and them.
Can you understand why the Israelis feel that the peace hasn't come, so they're building a wall to keep out the people who want to kill them?
Build it on the 1967 border. Why they have to confiscate hundreds of thousands of acres of Palestinian land?
Mr. Ayad, is there any way that you'll be able to go around the wall, even if it would mean driving a great distance?
I doubt it. I doubt it, because we have to have a special permit. Sometimes it takes months to come. When you have a lady that she needs to deliver, how you cannot wait for 1 month for her? I doubt it that we are able to live as a human being in this circumstances.
Waleed Ayad is a lecturer at the University of Abu Dhabi. He and his family live in East Jerusalem near the New Wall. Mr. Ayad, thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Tomorrow, we'll talk to a Jewish citizen of Jerusalem about living with the wall.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The Iowa caucuses are this coming Monday, as most anyone following politics with any degree of passion knows. But what may be less well known is what exactly a caucus is. To find out, we thought we'd turn to Professor Peverell Squire, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, to explain to us why Iowans can't just call their primary an election like any other state. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
And Professor, what's a caucus?
A caucus is a more time-intensive electoral device. The caucuses will require voters not to simply walk into a voting booth, cast their ballot, and leave, but rather they'll have to come, discuss the candidates, debate a little bit, and then vote in public.
Come to where?
Well, there will be precinct caucuses, almost 2,000 of them around the state, and so literally you'll be going with your neighbors to some facility in your neighborhood. In my case, the caucus will be in the high school auditorium.
Now, each neighborhood has a specific place they gather. You can't go across town somewhere else any more than you can vote outside your district.
Right. This is your voting district, and usually the precinct's caucuses will be held in some public facility, a school auditorium, a school gym, a fire station, that sort of thing.
How many Iowans typically gather at a caucus?
Well, we have had turnouts as high as 125,000 and somewhere much lower, around 60,000, and we expect it will probably be around the upper end this time.
And in an individual caucus, how many gather?
Well, it will vary from 10 or 20 people at the smallest to a couple of hundred at the largest.
Mm-hmm. Now, that very high number of 150,000, it tends to be more like 75,000, I believe, who actually take part in a caucus. What percentage of the population of Iowa would that be?
That's a relatively small proportion of the voting age population. On the Democratic side, if we actually get 125,000, which would be a pretty good turnout, it would be about 10 to 15% of voting age population.
So people gather at the caucus in their part of Iowa, in their neighborhood, and they discuss the candidates, right?
This is the unusual characteristic of the caucuses. People will have presentations from the various candidates. They'll talk about the candidates. They'll debate the candidates' various merits and demerits, and better inform themselves and publicly state their positions.
And that can go on for several hours.
It can take a while. If you're in one of the larger precincts and if you have some very talkative representatives of the candidates, it can take a while.
Are minds changed?
I think there are some people who go into the caucuses with very loose preferences about their choices or are simply undecided. And, of course, uncommitted is one of the categories they can support. So a few minds will be changed, and a lot of people will have a chance to talk publicly about their preferences.
Yeah. When the vote actually happens, do people raise their hands?
Generally, people go to different parts of the room. So you'll find the Gephardt people in one corner and the Dean people in another corner. And that way you can get some sense of the support across the range of candidates who are active.
And then they're just counted, not highly computerized.
They are counted up, and there are different thresholds that have to be met depending on the size of your caucus. And if your candidate is deemed not to be viable, and in the largest precincts that would mean if your candidate doesn't have the support of 15% of the people attending, then you can either try to persuade some people to join your caucus to make it viable, or you can go cast a vote for somebody else.
Now, does a candidate win by having the largest number of caucuses in favor of them, or is it a totality of vote across the state for a given candidate?
It will be the number of delegates that are elected. And technically what's happening here, the precinct caucuses are the first of four levels that take place here in the state. The precincts will elect delegates to the county, then the county to the congressional district to the state. And so what will actually be totaled up on caucus night is how many delegates each candidate gets from each of these precincts. These would be delegates going on to the county convention. And what the state party will do is make a calculation as to what percentage that is likely to suggest for the statewide delegate count.
There's been a little talk out there about cheating, candidates infiltrating supporters, not even necessarily Iowans, into caucuses. After all, caucus participants are supposed to be registered voters, but they can sign up as a registered voter that very night if they want to. Couldn't one candidate's out-of-state supporters simply sign up to vote that night and take part?
In theory, I suppose it could happen, but you have to remember these are precinct events, really neighborhood events. And it's unlikely that you'll be able to smuggle in many supporters for one of the candidates if these are people that are unfamiliar to everybody else at the caucus. So I don't think Dean or any of the other campaigns will be able to get people in that night and simply have them register and vote simply because they'll be seen as outsiders and it would be hard for them to pass as otherwise.
Yeah, the allegations were against the Dean camp, and we stress allegations. Just to finish up, is this system a good idea? Why not just go up to a nice touch screen and put your finger on it and vote for somebody?
Well, this is a different voting procedure, and it's one that harkens back really to the way we used to vote back in the 19th century. And it emphasizes somewhat different values than the current system that we see operating in almost all of our elections. What we see most in most parts of the country is really a system designed to increase participation. And that's always considered to be a good thing. What happens here in Iowa is really a system which allows people to really demonstrate some passion and some depth to their voting. This notion that you can go in and talk with your neighbors and perhaps persuade them and even have the opportunity, if your candidate doesn't seem to have much support, to maybe go to your second choice. And so it's a different system. It's a throwback system. And I think what it provides the nation at large is an opportunity to see the decisions of a group of voters who have, for the last year and a half, come to know the candidates in a way that the rest of the country won't have the opportunity to.
Professor Peverell Squire is a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll go to Iowa and New Hampshire as the caucuses and primary draw near.
And we'll talk with a doctor who's just returned from earthquake-ravaged Bam, Iran. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, an open secret on Wall Street exposed. Money managers paid to push some mutual funds over others.
These are some tactics that the average person might have expected to see on a car dealership lot, but you know, they had no idea that they could find this in something as important as their investment.
Also, inside Germany's secret fencing societies.
It's so fast. I mean, I remember this guy's arm coming up, and it was like a sapling branch swinging back and round, and it all of a sudden the blood started to gush.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. President Bush plans to unveil his plan today to put astronauts on the planet Mars and establish a permanent space station on the moon. Bush will ask for an immediate billion-dollar boost for NASA. The space agency's administrator, Sean O'Keefe, says the president wants to give NASA new direction to explore and discover. But O'Keefe says Bush will also have to explain why it is important in order to justify spending hundreds of billions of dollars. On Mars, NASA expects the rover Spirit to begin exploring the red planet later today or early tomorrow. The rover has repositioned itself on its platform and is ready to roll off the lander. NASA scientists hope Spirit will explore craters and distant hills, as well as search for evidence of the possible past presence of water. U.S. troops are arresting more Iraqis suspected of being involved with insurgents. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett says troops have captured number 54 on the coalition's most wanted list of Iraqis. He also says soldiers apprehended two other men suspected of organizing attacks in the tense town of Fallujah. And military officials say U.S. forces arrested four nephews of Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri, the former right-hand man to Saddam Hussein, who remains at large. Meanwhile, the Sunni Triangle region at the heart of the guerrilla war is seeing more violence. A car bomb exploded in front of a police station 40 miles north of Baghdad. The driver and two other Iraqis were killed, and 31 people were wounded. A revised design for the World Trade Center Memorial will add greenery and sunken reflection pools, marking the collapsed tower's footprints. New York Governor George Pataki says the memorial aptly captures what happened on 9/11.
It's here in that memorial center where we'll be able to see and to feel and to touch the twisted steel from the tower itself and see the pictures and the stories of our heroes, whether they be from Rescue 5 or any other entity that responded with such courage.
The design, reflecting absence, was chosen last week from eight finalists by a 13-member jury. The Connecticut legislature is forming a bipartisan committee to investigate Governor John Rowland. It'll be up to that committee to determine if the three-term Republican should be impeached. Rowland has admitted accepting gifts and other perks from politically connected friends, state employees, and a contractor. Rowland has refused to step down. On Wall Street, at midday, stocks are up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 72 points at 10,499. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
If you bought into mutual funds in the stock market boom, you were most likely not told that the person that sold you the fund was probably being compensated to promote that fund over others. In a 9-month investigation, the Securities and Exchange Commission found that the practice is widespread among the largest Wall Street brokerage firms and mutual funds. At a meeting today, the SEC is coming out with proposals to stop what some are calling a kind of mutual fund payola. Well, joining us on the line is Ian McDonald, who's the mutual funds columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And welcome, Ian.
Thanks very much for having me.
Ian, to start out, define for me, if you would, a term that has a lot to do with all this. It's called shelf space. What does that mean?
Well, shelf space is essentially the idea that your average broker has thousands of funds to choose from. It's a very crowded shelf. So to get some good placement on that, to get in front of brokers and to have them focus on your funds, some firms will essentially direct their trades that they make in their funds to that firm, mm-hmm. or actually give firms a percentage of sales or percentage of assets sold through their brokers. What it boils down to is that they're getting preferential treatment within a given firm because they're offering them higher compensation, not necessarily because their funds deserve more attention.
And it's not a new practice.
No, it's been going on for years and years. Essentially, what we're in all this mutual fund mess that we've been wading through, the saddest part is that a lot of these have been open secrets within the industry. The problem that that really has come up is that the average consumer has no idea that they're going on. That's deeply troubling.
Ian, you say these fees were an open secret among industry experts, if largely unknown to consumers. It was all legal, right?
Well, it was disclosed in the fine print within Prospectus
uh-huh.
that very few people read, and a lot of times the disclosure was particularly murky. It might say, for instance, we reserve the right to, we reserve the right to offer directed brokerage or to share revenue with a given brokerage firm that isn't named to facilitate marketing of the funds. And it's not only is it legalese, but it's deep in a filing that, frankly, sadly, a lot of folks never see or read.
Yeah. Now, what do you think the SEC is going to do today?
The SEC yesterday was talking about how in the next month or so they may be bringing charges against some brokerages and some mutual fund firms. They didn't name any names, but they may be charging folks where they've been particularly abusive. Today, what they're doing in their meeting is several things. What they're trying to do is make these deals at least adhere to the rules and also make them clear to investors. What they're going to float is, in the next couple months, is a new rule that would force brokers to make a disclosure of any incentives, any added incentives they have to sell a given fund over others, both at the point of sale, when they're selling you the fund, and also in the confirmation of the trade when you buy or sell the fund.
Is that going to be good enough? Why not just ban the fees altogether?
Well, I think that's what they're trying to suss out now. I think that these are some tactics that the average person might have expected to see on a car dealership lot, but they had no idea that they could find this in something as important as their investments. I think, frankly, that this stuff is pretty darn bad, and I think that's the one consensus everyone is coming around to now that they're being put in the light of day.
As you said, Ian, a lot of scandal in the mutual fund industry lately, it seems. Are we still in a tip of the iceberg situation where worse to come? How rattled should those of us who have something to do with mutual funds be?
Well, you can hardly be blamed for being rattled. I mean, there's 95 million Americans own shares of a mutual fund. We've entrusted more than $7 trillion of our money to these folks. And frankly, they let us down. But the most egregious claims are probably out. And one thing that people should remember is that while this is going to drag on for months, the basic question we have to look at is, will Wall Street and the fund world be a cleaner, fairer place for fund investors 5 years from now than it was 5 years ago? The answer to that is almost certainly a resounding yes.
Let me just ask you quickly to finish up. If this was an open secret for so long, why did it take the SEC so long to get at it?
Excellent question, and one that they are not particularly comfortable with. To be fair to them, they had a very small budget for given the amount of oversight they have to have, and also they figured that mutual funds were the least of their problems. When you look at Enron and WorldCom, the good news is that because of these scandals, they are getting a lot more examiners, they're getting a much bigger budget, and more of those people and dollars are going to be going into the area that oversees mutual funds.
Ian McDonald is the mutual funds columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Ian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Budget-strapped cities and towns are all looking to fill their coffers, but Pittsburgh is basically bankrupt, and it's proposing to raise parking taxes. And that is raising hackles. According to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, the parking tax in Pittsburgh is already the highest in the country. The city council is now proposing raising it from 31% to 50% on the dollar. Joining us on the line from Pittsburgh is Marianne Geyer, executive director of the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership, an organization which promotes the city. Welcome, Marianne.
Thank you. Welcome.
Can you give me a sense of just how this increase might affect largely the commuters who are coming in from outside of Pittsburgh to either shop or work downtown?
Right. Well, we've got 140,000 people a day who come into downtown Pittsburgh and call downtown Pittsburgh the place where they draw a paycheck to be able to provide for their families. And, you know, of that 140,000, 49% of them choose to use a car or some kind of vehicle other than mass transit that gets them in here. An increase to 50%, we feel, is going to have a detrimental effect not only to the workforce, but to the businesses that we count on to be able to provide the job opportunities for such a workforce.
Well, let's do the math. Let's say someone pays $10 a day to park. A 50% increase would add around, let's say, $4. So if someone comes in 20 days a month to Pittsburgh, that's an extra $80 a month. For each car, by the way, if the parking lot operator pays it. But if the parking lot operator passes along even half that cost, that means the commuter would pay an additional $30 or $40 a month to park.
Right. It could become extremely costly, and we feel that this clearly is a tipping point where it takes away from all of the wonderful attributes that downtown Pittsburgh does have to offer and starts to make it a location that is not approachable for business retention, business development, and other activities.
Well, what are the options? As you know better than anyone, the city's in trouble. So how else can the city raise money?
Right. Well, you know, one of the options is to have the legislature step forward and vote to authorize the city of Pittsburgh to raise their commuter tax. There are also, and it has not been raised in many, many, many years.
Even if the commuter tax of, what, $10 was raised, it couldn't match the $20, $30, $40 a month that the city might get from the parking tax.
Right. Well, the commuter tax, it's not just the commuter tax. There are a variety of taxes that the legislature needs to look at and help to enact so that the city of Pittsburgh can restructure their tax base. We need people to understand that the city of Pittsburgh is at a tipping point right now, and it's all within our grasp. We can all make the decision. Do we want Pittsburgh to survive or not?
Marianne, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Marianne Geyer, Executive Director of the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Still to come, inside the secret dueling societies of Germany, they fence for real and make powerful friendships for life. You're listening to Here and Now.
Say the words pit bull, and most people think of a fierce dog that would tear your leg off if it had a chance. But the new director of animal care and control in New York City thinks the pit bull gets a bad rap. Ed Boakes is director of the Dog Pound in New York. He proposed changing the name of pit bulls to New Yorkies. He joins us now on the line from New York City. Welcome, Mr. Boakes.
Pleasure to be here.
Why did you come up with this idea to rename the pit bull the New Yorkie?
Well, New York City has undertaken a difficult challenge, and that is to try to end euthanasia as a means of pet overpopulation control within the five boroughs of New York. And we rescue in the neighborhood of well over 6,000 pit bulls every year. And most of those animals are just wonderful, wonderful animals and could make wonderful pets. 90% of them are unfortunately euthanized. Hmm. And so we're developing strategies to get as many animals adopted as possible.
And so you were just trying to save the lives of these dogs that you say are not nearly as bad as their reputation indicates.
Well, I think people need to understand that pit bulls, there is cause for concern. And when you adopt a pit bull, it's an environmental issue. Pit bulls are good dogs that can be made bad. Uh-huh. And it's going to be the owner that's going to make them bad. They're not inherently a bad animal. And they can, you know, if they're in a loving environment, they're going to be a loving pet. If they're in an environment where they are trained to be aggressive or fight or attack, they will do that.
So, Mr. Brooks, what you're saying is that a pit bull puppy could be brought into any average home, including a home with children, and if trained properly, not be a danger to that family.
Well, if you adopt a puppy, if you adopt an older animal, again, you need to understand whatever breed, whether it's a golden retriever or a poodle, and certainly with a pit bull, that if it's not well cared for and loved, and that if it turns on you, the results could be a little more disastrous than, you know, a toy poodle.
So who objected to the plan?
You know, it was a strategy. It was something that actually the media got a hold of before we had even implemented it. It was, you know, it was a balloon that we were going to send up and see how New Yorkers would respond to it. And it got sent up a little earlier than we had anticipated. It wasn't our intention to offend anybody. And the intention was to save lives. And it had become more of a distraction than anything.
The pit bull, will it get renamed the New Yorkie, or is that idea probably not going to work out?
We're not pursuing it. That's for sure.
Yeah. How many dogs are euthanized around the country every year?
Well, several years ago, we were euthanizing in the neighborhood of 17 million a year.
Wow.
Estimates now are down in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 million. So we've made incredible progress over the last decade. And every community, I believe, can achieve this, what we call no-kill objective, which is ending the euthanasia of healthy, adoptable animals.
Now, Mr. Boakes, I understand in your campaign to lessen the euthanasia of pit bulls, you very immediately were trying to save the lives of some 16 dogs that were on death row. Tell me about that and what their status is now.
Well, actually, there were 16 that we rescued from an operation that was just about to start training these animals for fighting.
Mm.
And we got to them just in time. We evaluated them health-wise and temperament-wise, and they're just very adoptable, wonderful animals. And, yes, we have placed all 16 of those animals.
Ed Boakes is the new director of Animal Care and Control in New York City. Mr. Boakes, thanks so much for joining us.
Bill, thank you. Take care.
There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In competitive fencing, some things are understood. The blade is not sharpened, and in any event, you'd never purposefully scar your opponent's face. Well, those rules are turned upside down in modern-day secret dueling societies in Germany, fraternal organizations that draw on ancient rituals and draw blood as a sign of honor. Members in these German clubs are scarred for life, but also made for life, with well-placed fraternal brothers in the business and political corridors of Germany. Jonathan Green, a fencer from England, spent 8 months trying to gain access to these secret German societies, and he succeeded. He recently wrote about a duel he witnessed in Göttingen, Germany, and he joins us now from the rather safe distance of New York. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello. Hi.
Well, first of all, let's just try to set the scene and paint the picture, which you do beautifully in your article in the Financial Times, but what are some of the things that these fencers do or wear?
Well, they wear chain mail. There's protection around the neck to protect the carotid artery. They also wear steel sort of goggles on their sort of faces so that the nose and the eyes can't be scarred. But anything above the neckline is a target. And they also wear chain mail sort of shirts to protect their sort of upper arms and torsos as well.
There's drinking involved. There are doctors standing by to sew up the wounds, and they are required to be absolutely impassive.
Yeah. I mean, the big sort of thing with this is that it's a test of manhood. So to flinch in any way or to shirk means that you're instantly disqualified and you've got to do the whole thing all over again.
Mm. Who joins these groups?
I think it's people from well-bred families. It's normally they have an introduction from their fathers or their grandfathers who are old boys of the cause, known as Alteherren. And that's normally how they join. But I think in the past sort of 10, 20 years, they're starting to have new sort of like recruits from people who are just sort of fascinated with it and want to join.
Well, we read in your article there are 200 of these student corps in Germany. And many Germans just hate them.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they sort of accuse them of being sort of Nazis. And I think that, you know, because any secret society tends to draw criticism from people who don't know what it's about. And I think that that's why they sort of let me into their world to, you know, to sort of show me and to say, hey, look, you know, that's about the furthest thing away that we are. Like, we're not sort of Nazis at all. We just hark back to the German traditions which go back five centuries or so.
Mm. And in fact, you know, obviously they preceded the Nazis by hundreds of years and were banned in some cases by Nazis for defending their Jewish members for not kowtowing to Hitler.
Yes, that's totally right. I mean, the corps sort of have such a strict code of honor that once you join and you show that you're part of the fraternity, then they'll do, you know, then they will take care of you. And that goes beyond any class, race, because religious thing, it cuts across everything.
Well, cuts.
Excuse me, yes.
Excuse
the pun, yeah.
Because they do cut each other. I mean, and then what? They belong to this organization and sometimes live in these beautiful old homes that house these organizations for hundreds of years. But then does it really help them down the road?
I don't know. I mean, some people say it does and other people say it doesn't. I mean, I don't think, you know, that it's such a sinister organization that they're sort of guaranteed a job and this, that and the other. But I do think it's probably a bit like being in the military, sort of being in the Marine Corps. I mean, at the end of that, I mean, you have a tight bond with the people that you've seen service with.
What was it like for you to stand there and watch this duel? I mean, there's super sharp blades, which just even reading about it made my heart jump. What was your reaction?
There's times when you really don't want to look at it. You just want to turn away. I mean, you're waiting on that cut. And they go sort of back and forth and back and forth. And every sort of four swipes, they clean the blade and then they do another four. And then sort of to when it happens, it's so fast. I mean, I remember this guy's arm sort of coming up and it was like a sapling branch swinging back and round. And it sort of split open like because this other guy's forehead with just this barely discernible needle thin line, this red line, and then all of a sudden the blood started to gush and went down over his goggles and the chain mail. And I think even up to that point he didn't even realize that he had been cut, you know. I think that the sort of adrenaline was coursing that sort of strongly. But there was also a tremendous amount of fear in the room. I mean, one of the fencers, they have to sort of hold their swords aloft sort of before they start. And I literally saw this guy's hand sort of shaking like an antenna on a car. I mean, it was absolutely terrified.
I can almost hear it, you know.
Well, there is actually that sort of snick in the air, which is, you know, which is a strong memory I have of it. It's this sort of rhythmic snicking noise of the blades going through the air. And because there's no other sort of sound at all, actually. But I think, yeah, I mean, some people just can't go through with it and sort of back out. And then, of course, they can't sort of be in the core, you know.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Jonathan Green's story about the secret German fencing societies appeared recently in the Financial Times Weekend magazine. It's also posted on our website, here-now.org. Finally today, New York police in Manhattan and the Hamptons are searching for monologuist Spalding Gray. The 62-year-old writer and actor was reported missing after failing to turn up at a friend's house Saturday night. Spalding Gray has a history of depression, which was reportedly made worse by a car accident 3 years ago in Ireland. He always shared his innermost demons through his monologues. His best-known, Swimming to Cambodia, was first performed in 1982 on stage and made into a film 6 years later. In this clip, Gray talks about waiting to hear if he's landed a part in the movie The Killing Fields.
And as I went out, I found that I was turning the doorknob three times. Threes became a crucial, very important magical number. I was going 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and knocking on wood when I could find wood. Find wood, six sets of nine and six and three and nine, snapping on my way to the supermarket to buy soup. You know, six sets of nine, nine times. Every third can was fine. The first two cans of soup had botulism, you see, or cyanide. And I thought, you know, Spalding, you're going to end up in the insane asylum before you get the role in the film.
Spalding Gray got the role in that film. WBUR's theater critic Bill Marks joins us. And Bill, are you shocked that he's missing?
Not really, no. He attempted to commit suicide in 2002, and I saw him the same year in a revival of Swimming to Cambodia at Sanders Theater at Harvard University. And he talked about the accident that had happened in Ireland, and he was visibly in pain. Mm-hmm. He limped when he came on stage. And although people loved the revival of Swimming to Cambodia, he had a question and answer period at the end of the production where he asked people whether they enjoyed it or not. He seemed to have become somewhat skeptical or not confident of his own talent. Mm.
He is called a new wave Mark Twain, a WASP Woody Allen.
He has also been called a postmodern Woody Allen. And in a sense, he had many of the themes of Woody Allen, in the sense that his humor was fatalistic, often dealing with the most horrible things that can happen to you. And as you could hear in that clip, he made humor out of it by trying to find ways to ward off what he thought would be terrible things.
Mm. Well, Spalding Gray is reported missing, and we wait to hear. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Marks, theater critic with WBUR. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now. We'll go to Iowa and New Hampshire as the caucuses and primary draw near. And we'll talk with a doctor who's just returned from earthquake-ravaged Bam, Iran. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.